Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast with an unconventional narrative arc. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, I'm a partner of propaganda with Steve Hames.
Hey, Corey.
Now, Steve, we like to think of ourselves as modernizers, as up-to-date politicos, reinventing podcasting for the world and the society and the times that we live in.
And we're so humble about it as well.
The most humble, in fact. And this is why this episode is based on a blog written from 2012. It's by Damien McBride, who was a former communications chap for Gordon Brown. I think was known as McPoison because he was a positive,
charming character.
He was positive to be around. In fact, I imagine if Malcolm Tucker is Alistair Campbell, or rather I should say if Alistair Campbell is Malcolm Tucker, because it's Alistair Campbell who's the real person, Jamie McDonald from the thick of it, I'm guessing, is basically Damien McBride. But he wrote a memoir, which is very, very good, and then became a blogger as well. The blog in particular is a chapter in his collected blogs. And it's called The Seven Plots of Politics. And the idea is, just as there are, it talks about there being seven basic plots. I forget what they are in novels. Is it something like you've got the quest and things?
Yeah, you've
like
got
that?
The journey, overcoming the monster. Seven basic plots, all of which apparently can be found in The Lord of the Rings, which is why The Lord of the Rings is one of the greatest literary works ever. So says Christopher Booker, who was one of the people who espouses this theory, at least.
I mean, I was with you up until greatest works of literature, but I realised we're going to get a lot of hate mail for that, so I'll move on. But McBride then argues, just as there are seven basic plots which you can find, basically boil down in every work of literature, mediocre or great, there are seven basic stories which are being played out in the careers of almost all politicians and which repeat themselves endlessly and have done for centuries. So what we'll do is we'll go through what the seven plots are, we'll think about how can we fit both old politicians, both young and old, into those plots, and what is the value of thinking about those plots. So the first plot: principled or maverick individual succeeds because of their principled or maverick approach. Power changes them, leaving their supporters disappointed. And the obvious, I suppose, answer for me was Jeremy Corbyn. You can see with his position over Brexit, there's a lot of people who were supporting Corbyn who now see him as more of an equivocating figure.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an element to this. And I think with anything to do with Corbyn, obviously his narrative hasn't been finished yet. When it comes to his political story arc, everything is kind of does remain to be seen, but based on whatever ending he gets. But you can start to see like the outlines of this plot already being written in the way that an awful lot of the pro-European elements of British political society are reacting to him these days.
I do also think that actually, as a person, I don't think he's really changed at all. And I mean that in a positive way, actually.
The Jeremy Corbyn that we have today is the Jeremy Corbyn that we had 20 years ago, if not 30 years ago. I mean, there's a bit of a running joke that his views haven't shifted on anything effectively ever. And that's kind of largely true.
I also think that it's also someone like Nigel Farage as well, were he ever to become any significant power player, this is what Farage would be as well.
Well, it pretty much what this plot is almost like the typical journey of anybody who's kind of like on the fringes of politics, rising up to a position of power and influence. You get into like the position of power, and one of two things happens: either you can't fulfill the promises you've made because you've been populist or whatever, in which case you just disappoint everybody and your career ends up in flames. Or you get there and you realise, right, the only way we can make this work is doing X, Y, and Z. And that means compromising with reality, which in turn annoys people and means your career ends up kind of crashing in flames.
Boris Johnson maybe also, if he becomes Prime Minister?
Big if there, but yes. Yeah, possibly.
Okay, second plot. Charismatic would-be king is thwarted by ruthless, unworthy opponents, ends up exiled and frustrated in life. I mean, this, I think, is Edward Heath, except he was the king, not a would-be king.
Yeah, but he still ended up exiled, sent to the backbenches, never really engaged with anything again.
No, I mean, that was very much a self-inflicted exile. He just sulked. But it's definitely, I think, Heath is part of it.
More modern-day equivalent of that, if you replace exile with joining up with the Thunderbirds, it's David Miliband, after he swanned off to join International Rescue.
David Miliband is definitely part of this. Michael Heseltine, not really, because I suppose he was Deputy Prime Minister afterwards, so... Mm. Maybe he was for a little bit after Westland, but not really. This is what Gavin Williamson thinks he is.
Yeah, this is what Gavin Williamson wishes he was, because it meant he was actually influential.
Also, it would mean charismatic, and to describe the assassin-faced baby as charismatic stretches the dictionary definition to the limit.
I'm pretty sure we'd be pulled up by the Advertising Standards Agency if we utilise that description.
But if you are taking pictures of yourself in pubs with George Osborne, there's a definite would-be king nature to that.
There's a definite wannabe nature to it.
Yes. Is this how the Boris Johnson narrative arc actually plays out?
Ending up in exile, in the back benches. I mean, the thing with Johnson is he's ended up in exile in the back benches multiple times at this point, and has somehow still managed to worm his way back in to being a public figure in some capacity with power and influence. Obviously, at some point that will end. Fundamentally, it depends on whether or not he's able to actually acquire the leadership of the Conservative Party, which I'm not convinced he will. So I'd say it's more likely than not at this point that he ends up in exile.
A prediction.
I know, it's dangerous.
I didn't know it was going to be one of those episodes. I had to start drinking. Third plot. For years, the heir to the throne yearns restlessly for the crown. Finally gets it at some price, but fortune turns against them.
Now, I'm thinking of a former Chancellor of the Exchequer. First name starts with G, second name starts with B. Can you work out who I'm thinking of?
Is it George Brown? There you go. I think he was Foreign Secretary, though.
Yeah, it's true, he was. Yeah. This is obviously Gordon Brown.
That could literally also be George Brown.
You could actually, yeah, now I think about it. Gordon Brown, I think, is the best example of this, given he spent seemingly the entirety of his time in Number 11 just desperately trying to get rid of Tony Blair as soon as possible.
He ran the economy at the same time. I think he was multitasking.
Well, yes, but...
The older equivalent, I think, is Anthony Eden as well. And again, there's Harold Macmillan's comment, isn't there, that I think Eden was trained to run the Derby in 1938, but wasn't allowed to run the race until 1955. I suppose the thing with this narrative arc is that these kinds of prime ministers who come in midway through or towards the end of a government's period in office, like Eden, like Crown, like Callaghan,
May,
it tends to be the government's already been in office for quite a bit of time, and so the administration is running out of steam, and you tend to be up against an opposition that's been revitalised as well.
When I was at university, I did a British history pop politics module, basically, and one of the essays that I think we had to write about, do prime ministers who take over mid-term always seem to struggle? So there is a known kind of identifiable trend of if you take over midway through, you're going to end up struggling.
I suppose it's partly just swings and roundabouts of being in government, isn't it? I'm sure there's a study on the governors in Texas and how whether or not a governor in Texas gets re-elected is down to the oil price. There are lots of factors outside of your control.
Absolutely.
When you are a new government, you can blame the opposition for it. If you've been in government for 10 years...
It's really difficult to say anything about it. Yeah, take a look at the coalition. You know, they were able to say, we don't want to do this, we've got to do this because Labour spent all the money. Theresa May hasn't got that excuse anymore. She's just got to go, we're not going to do it.
Plot number four. Two individuals rise to power together, but eventually destroy one another, either through blind loyalty or the emergence of distrust.
Well, that would be the TBGBs all over.
Yeah. Also, David Cameron and George Osborne over Brexit, because it was George Osborne said that we shouldn't have the referendum.
Yeah.
And then agreed to it out of loyalty to Cameron. And look where it got him.
Yeah.
The editorship of the Evening Standard. It's tragic, really.
And various chairs of all kinds of ridiculous jobs, which he works four days a week, month on. I think there's also potentially, like, we talked about Corbyn a little bit earlier, and I said how his narrative hasn't been finished yet. I do think there is potential here that for Corbyn and McDonnell, that this is a possible outcome for them. In that, really, like, McDonnell has been very, very loyal to Corbyn. Like, there's been seemingly very little kind of personal plotting, and whilst there have been some differences of opinion, there's never really been any doubt that McDonnell is on board the Corbyn leadership train. Which means if it could very well, depending on how things go for old Jezza, McDonnell could go down with that sinking ship if it all goes to pot. In which case, that loyalty could be the end of both of them. In that, actually, I think McDonnell is one of the few people that could turn around to Corbyn and say, no, wake up, deal with this issue in this sort of way, and Jeremy might actually listen. But if Corbyn doesn't do that because he's loyal to Corbyn because he's the leader and his friend, well, that screws them both over.
I think this is quite a popular plot because it's quite Shakespearean.
It is very Shakespearean.
Same as the next plot we're going to look at. I think writers just like this idea. And again, when you've got a news media outlet, which quite a news environment, which quite likes looking for differences, trying to find little things to wedges to drive between people. Yeah, it's a nice plot. It can make good copy.
Mm-hmm.
Plot, as I said, plot number five, also quite Shakespearean. A great individual has one fatal flaw or makes one great mistake, which undoes them and damages their reputation.
Where do we begin? Shall we start with Chamberlain? And go with the peace in our time.
Yes. So there's that. So there's Chamberlain,
Eden, Suez.
Yeah. I was going to say Callaghan and the Winter of Discontent because yeah. he was doing as a prime that could possibly have won a November election in 1978 had he called it. Was comfortably polling ahead of Thatcher in terms of personal ratings, and then the trade unions happened.
Yeah, so just continuing on with this, Blair and Iraq would be the biggie for the more modern prime ministers. Cameron and Brexit, obviously.
It does say great individual. That's why I didn't mention John Major and the ERM. So maybe that's the difference. Like, what is the difference between, say, John Major and the ERM? Like, that event torpedoes the Major government. What's the difference between that and, say, like Eden and Suez? Eden had been a very, very successful foreign secretary who then gets torpedoed. Is there a slightly different plot then of personal prime ministers like Blair and Eden who are taken down and then events that torpedo entire governments?
So I think the thing here is that Major, largely speaking, was able to rehabilitate his image. So his story and his arc didn't actually end there. John Major these days is viewed as like what's the term I'm looking for?
Grey.
Yeah. John Major is viewed as one of those kind of like aging leaders that's like, it's actually worth listening to and kind of taking his opinion on. And in a lot of the way in the US, every current president tends to seek advice of every former president because they're the only ones who know what the job entails and all of that.
That's happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely. But Major has managed to kind of get this almost like, it's not quite national treasure status, obviously, but his image has been rehabilitated and he's not necessarily viewed in the same kind of negative light as some of the other individuals who had these big events that occurred which just screwed up their reputations permanently.
I don't think I mentioned this one as well. If we think about people who aren't prime ministers, Nick Clegg and tuition fees.
Yes.
Undoubtedly.
Arguably just the entirety of the coalition decision.
Just everything that he did. But the interesting thing with the Nick Clegg story arc is that if you'd written the film, the narrative arc is he loses his seat in 2015. Because at that point, 2017, the Commons losing one of its more ardently pro-Remain figures. And especially when you extend that narrative arc beyond 2017, the fact that he lost it to Jared O'Mara adds a bit of an extra sting in the tail of that narrative too, really. Because it's someone who essentially probably wasn't a very good MP.
Clegg's kind of story is just actually kind of proof that life doesn't work in nice narrative sweeps. with a nice resolution, which, not that everybody's happy, but that kind of makes a nice ending.
Now works for Facebook. Is that a good? Is that a happy ending?
I'm sure it is for him and his wife and kids.
There is that. I wonder. And again, the problem with this is the adjective "great" that's in there. But Theresa May calling the snap election.
Yes.
100%. And again, and that actually that's different to the John Major thing in that it wasn't John Major, I don't think, that took Britain into the ERM. Whereas, like with Eden and Suez, there's a definite cause
and effect. Yeah, it was their active decisions. Granted, Eden was off his head on pain medications at the time.
There's a lot of ketamine involved, yes. I would say, but then May in the snap election, it was very much a...
This was her decision. No one knew it was coming because she literally did decide it while she was out walking in the foothills of Wales. Yeah, and I think that probably is the thing. And you did briefly allude to this earlier in that the difference maybe between... Blair, the difference between maybe Blair, Eden and Major is that their actions that we associate them with were of their own demise and their own making. The ERM fiasco was something that happened whilst Major was in power, and it certainly didn't help his reputation, the Tories' reputation, but he wasn't the architect of it.
Plot number six. A ruthless leader lives and dies by the sword, destroyed by their own pride and paranoia, and often assassinated by their own protégés.
Boris with Gove?
Yeah, I think there's a definite Boris Gove thing going on, or Johnson Gove thing going on. Margaret Thatcher as well, I feel, is the prototype of this type of thing. Someone who didn't exactly treat her cabinet with a lot of peace, love and understanding, and then was knifed by them. Before that...
There's an argument, again, you could say Chamberlain, who basically took all of the blame for the Norway fiasco during the run-ups, during the phony war period of the Second World War, which was all Churchill's screw-up, largely.
Norfolk, and then, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then Churchill took all of... obviously became Prime Minister after that. Maybe.
Yeah, certainly Chamberlain being destroyed by his own pride as well, and the way that Chamberlain handled himself in the 1940 debate over Norway is probably what that there was a couple of fits of pique that led him to resign, weren't they? It's hard because often assassinated by their own protégés. So you can think of leaders who've been unseated like Min Campbell and Ian Duncan Smith. Maybe Ian Duncan Smith is partly payback for Maastricht. There's a nice end there in that he was never really loyal. I can't really see Min Campbell, bless him, being described as a ruthless leader who lives and dies by the sword.
No, but he was knifed by his proteges in the form of Chris Hume and Nick Clegg, so that bit at least works. I mean, I think what we've got to bear in mind with these is that McBride has written these descriptions of the plots with a certain amount of dramatic flourish to them. And whilst you're getting at various points, we've gone, I dispute the use of the word great for this person, but it broadly does fit the brushstrokes of this story element. That's the bit to focus on, rather than, because what makes a great person is subjective in every single way.
You floppy relativist.
I know, I am the worst.
Well, that's not very relative though, is it? Plot number seven. A canny foot soldier rises to the top, using the mind more than the sword, but is never comfortable with power and is replaced by a more natural-born leader.
We were having a discussion about this earlier, and we did think that maybe this was the Tim Farron story.
It's the only one, I think, that Tim... Given that there isn't actually a story about pixies.
No. But yeah, this is the one that with the best fit. It's just the replacing with a more natural leader in the form of Vince Cable, or the many faces of Vince Cable.
There must be at least one of Vince Cable's many personalities that isn't Vince Cable, the natural leader.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing. We do give Vince an awful lot of stick on the podcast, but I do think it is fair to say that when you compare him to Tim Farron, Vince is someone who's much more comfortable being in positions where he can and will take difficult decisions. We've got a track record of that. May not like the decisions, may not like the outcomes, and it may not have gone well for him and his party as the result, but he made the decisions, something Farron refused to do.
No one wants their political obituary to be better than leadership than Tim Farron. I would say, though, wasn't it Farron who makes the decision to make the Lib Dems explicitly the anti-Brexit pro-Remain party?
It was, yes.
So he did make... Like, that decision has been set in stone.
Yes, but that was him just kind of going with the tide of the party membership rather than... And again, this goes back to the notion of what makes a great leader. Are you a great leader if you're just kind of following along with the opinion of people, or are you a great leader by standing up to that opinion? Entire, I'm sure, philosophical tracts have been written on that argument.
I think this is how Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn's story arc could end. Certainly, this is how the Tories want May's to end, isn't it?
Yeah.
Certainly since the election a couple of years ago, she's not really looked comfortable in her own skin.
Yeah.
And the way back for the Tories, I think what they must be thinking in their own particular bunker is, we get rid of May, we get in a nice, good, charismatic leader, we give them 2 years and they call an election, or even a year and call an election. That, I think, is the Tories' way. With Jeremy Corbyn, I think it's very different. But if one considers it just essentially as being a way of making Labour a more left-wing party, and I think that is what Corbyn's done.
Right? Yeah.
And then I think it depends on, it is then who succeeds him. If, from certainly the Momentum's point of view, if they can find a good left-wing successor that they all rally behind, whether that be Angela Rayner, Emily Thornberry, people even talk about Rebecca Long-Bailey or Laura Pidcock, someone like that, you can see the Corbyn arc ending like this too.
Quite possibly, but it really does depend. As I say, we're into predictions territory there.
And we don't want to do that, so...
I've already made one, accidentally.
Yeah, no more than one prediction per episode. What's the use of these plots then?
I think this is where, kind of like this sort of analysis is kind of... It's very... fun and interesting from our perspective as politicos, but the practical applications of it are kind of limited. The very nature of these sorts of kind of set of plot devices, where we say, oh yeah, there are only X many stories, and everything tends to follow these kind of preconceived notions within them, is that actually they tend to be very, very broad. Now, that's not to say that this doesn't have a use, but it needs to be taken with a kind of a pinch of salt, I feel. And I think what McBride says is that this is a kind of an analytical tool for politicians to look at where they are and try and identify what their narrative they are currently in, what their story currently is, so that they can go, am I happy with this? Do I want to try and change it? Now, that's good, but fundamentally that's just a tool for good media management. It's not at all for good governance. So what this is kind of a nice little thing for politicians to take stock of every now and again to see what they might need to improve upon and do a bit of analysis that way. But it's not really going to revolutionise anything overall, I would say.
No, I mean, one of the things McBride says is that politicians should read a lot of film and literature to get an idea of stories and to think about what stories they're in and whether or not it needs changed. And the example he gives in the art blog itself is on Hamburger Hill, which is it's a Vietnam War film, I think. And apparently, the 2012 Tory Party conference, Cameron and his team were watching Hamburger Hill and essentially start comparing the assault on the deficit and the government's economic strategy to the Hamburger Hill film, forgetting that actually in real life, Hamburger Hill was a strategic disaster for the Americans, and they lose the hill a few weeks afterwards anyway because they can't hold it. Which actually, in many ways, fits
our narrative, yeah.
Well, there we go.
With the power of hindsight, but obviously Cameron and co. did not realise that at the time.
No. But yeah, it's much more about a media narrative thing than a government's thing. It's the stories that journalists will look for, and I suppose it's partly, okay, what narrative am I in? Do I have to change it? But I think it's also, how can I make sure that I rail against the narrative?
Yeah.
We talked about Corbyn and McDonnell in terms of the fourth narrative in saying that one way it could end is by...
them bringing each other down, yeah, either through internecine like rivalry or just blind loyalty.
Yeah, and definitely like McDonnell's been super loyal to Corbyn as someone that's been his friend for 20, 30 mm-hmm. years. And I think he's conditioned maybe partly by this narrative, but he's also then conditioned by the Blair Brown TBGBs as well.
Yeah.
So it's all about stories and also about one's own experience too.
Yeah. I think really what's for me is fascinating about this kind of analysis that McBride's thrown together though is just how everything ends in disaster. There's no happy ending in any of this. There's no, this person rise off into the sunset. It's, you end up in exile, you're brought down by your own right, by your rival, somebody stabs you in the back. It's tragedy. The narrative, basically what McBride is saying is that all political careers end in tragedy and end in disaster for that individual.
I mean, that's the Enoch Powell quote, isn't it? All political careers end in failure. And I mean, for a lot of politicians, their career ends in a failure and a defeat at the ballot box. We talked about Nick Clegg.
Yeah.
But you think about prime ministers. Cameron had to resign after a humiliating referendum defeat. Brown loses an election. Blair ends up having to resign because of an internal coup. Major thumping electoral defeat in 1997. Thatcher,
pushed out by her own party.
Indeed. Callaghan, government ends in absolute turmoil, loses an election. Wilson, actually, Harold Wilson is the only prime minister in the last 40 or so years who left at a time of his own
choosing.
And even that, you know, if you read Bernard Donoghue's diaries on those 2 years, it's not like it's a happy time. And there's, you can see he, like, Wilson's drinking heavily, that he's got ideas that there's a coup, an internal plotting against him. Even despite that, he's maybe the only one who leaves on his own terms, but not many cabinet ministers do. And I suppose then, even with a lot of very successful cabinet ministers, people like Michael Heseltine or Dennis Healey say, it's always that unspoken one, you didn't quite become prime minister and you really wanted to.
Yeah, there's always, even if they've been successful, there's always a bitterness in almost like a bitter aftertaste in their tale of they didn't quite achieve everything they wanted to.
Well, I mean, look at Clement Attlee, who again we talk about as being one of the most successful politicians and prime ministers of all time, left in defeat at the ballot box, lost to Churchill.
Well, on that sombering and cheerful note,
this podcast isn't going to end in failure. It's going to end with a few links and thank yous. So we have a website, notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. We have a Twitter page. It's going to end in forgetfulness, like the end of Harold Wilson's premiership. We've got a Twitter page, which is @NoChampagnePod. James Crown designed our logo, and Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm @PaperbackRioter.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
Happy plotting.